Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to today's edition of A Podcast to Be Named Later. Glad to have you on board. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and today we're going to continue to talk about what's been going on here in September baseball. RotoExperts.com expert George Kurtz is going to be joining me today. We're going to do some players in focus. We're also going to look at the pennant races a little bit. We talked about it with Brandon C. Williams. We're going to continue talking about it with George Kurtz. There's nothing bad about getting multiple of opinions from a variety of different people who are knowledgeable in this. And so what we're going to be doing today, the players we're going to focus on, four quick ones. One, I want to talk about Gary Sanchez because George is a New York guy. He's a New Yorker. So I'm going to ask him as much as I can about the Mets and the Yankees to get a little bit of insight on what he's seeing and hearing on the ground. So I want to ask him about Gary Sanchez, get a little bit of fantasy projection from him as well. We're going to be talking baseball today. We mostly talk baseball, but because baseball is impacted by fantasy sports and we're fantasy sports guys as well as baseball people, I like to swerve in and out of lanes and talk a little baseball to bring in the fantasy perspective and kind of mesh it all together. So we're going to talk about Gary Sanchez and what he's been able to do since promoted and also talk about his future from a baseball perspective. And then we'll give you a little bit of a look about his fantasy projections, because I was talking about this with Brandon C. Williams yesterday about Treya Turner, and I have a similar question I want to ask George about Gary Sanchez. So we'll get into him today. We'll also talk about real quickly Yenis Cespedes. How well is he playing right now? Can he carry the Mets into the playoffs like he did last season? Is he going to opt out? Things like that. I'm curious because I think he's opting out. I've said that I don't think the Mets are going to make the playoffs. It's hard for me to make a really convincing case that they're not going to make the playoffs, but they haven't clinched it or anything. There's still very much a good chance that they could miss it, and Cespedes is going to be a crucial part of whether they make it or not, in my opinion. So I'm going to ask George about that. And again, since we're talking Mets, Yankees, and things like that, I'm going to ask about Daniel Murphy. I know he's no longer a Met. I know that he's a National. That's what I want to ask George about. What was Daniel Murphy's impact last year? What is it like now that he's a National and the fact that the Mets don't have him? If Daniel Murphy was a Met, would they be winning the division and the Nationals wouldn't? Those are some questions I want to ask George about when it comes to players in focus. And then, as I said, we'll quickly brush over the division races. We'll look at who's going to win the AL East. We're going to look at the wild cards for both the American League and the National, and then we'll get the heck out of here in hopefully 30 to 40 minutes. So I also asked George real quickly about the unbalanced schedule. That's something I've been curious about, and I want to get his thoughts on it. The fact that it really kind of looks like the AL East is getting screwed over here this year. Coming into the season, supposedly the AL East was the worst division in baseball. Well, they've got four teams with 77 wins or more, the only division that has that. I believe they're the only division with four teams above 500. There are four 70-game winners in the AL Central, but the White Sox are still four games behind under 500. So I think a pretty good argument can be made that the AL East isn't the worst or anything far from it, that it's probably the best. So we'll get into that real quickly. And the fact that the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Orioles and the Blue Jays all fighting for playoff spots all play each other. I think the Yankees have three games against the Dodgers, which is a series going on right now. Other than that, they have something like 27 or 28 games all against AL East teams. How that's beneficial or not beneficial to one team or another is beyond me, and I love it. And that's what the conflict with me is. I love the unbalanced schedule because there are so many important games right now for the remainder of the season for all of us to focus on. But let's face it, it is not. Being in the AL West is a lot friendlier than being in the AL East, in my opinion. It's been that way for decades, and you look at it now. I'd love to have 20 games against the Angels, the Oakland A's, and maybe three or so against the Mariners and the Houston Astros, rather than six against the Jays and six against the Orioles and 10 against the Yankees and so forth and so on. So we'll get into that a little bit as well. But let me bring George Kurtz into the program here today. Before I give a little bit of program information, if you want to follow us on Facebook, it's a podcast to be named later if you want to talk baseball with us. Or you can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73. And you can follow George at George Kurtz. And, of course, all these podcasts are posted over at minorleagueball.com. George, thanks for coming on today. Love talking some baseball with you. How's everything going down there in New York? We got fantastic baseball weather up here in Boston.
Yeah, it's been exciting here. The Yankees unexpectedly still in the playoff race. Even some might say the Mets are unexpectedly in the race after all the injuries to their pitching staff. So I think it's safe to say that New York has some baseball fever.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I was actually trolling a couple of Yankee blogs on Facebook the other day, and I saw one that I think was probably years overdue, but one of the people said, I'm so glad they got rid of all these old vets and they're going with the youth movement and that we're seeing these young players actually perform well. Oftentimes, that doesn't always happen. Young guys struggle. Consistency is not usually something that we see from rookies. But the Yankees, obviously, since the trade deadline, they get rid of two elite relievers, and they actually look like they're playing significantly better. Is that the feeling now? Is this going to open up a door for Brian Cashman where he can sell things? He doesn't necessarily have to go out and sign every single free agent that comes on the board. Did he actually buy himself maybe a little leeway with the fans, and maybe this could impact the way he does things in the future, or am I overdoing it?
Well, fans are, they don't always understand the intricacies of how a team is run or what's good and what's bad. You know, fans will always remember the bad. Always. They don't remember the good. You know, we're a negative society in that essence. When you look at things, the Yankees had to do what they did, mainly because next year's free agent crop is far from bountiful. You're not going to be able to, remake your team by free agency. There's just not much out there. So the Yankees weren't going to be able to go that direction. Listen, Chapman, if the Yankees want him back, they're signing him, right? He's a free agent at the end of the year. If they want him back, they'll get him back. Andrew Miller, not so much, but he was a luxury. What I mean by that is next year, if you want Chapman, great. He's your ninth inning guy. If you want Patantis, great. He's your eighth inning guy. So did you really need another lockdown reliever? Do you really not have anybody else in the organization who could do that anyway for you? So to get the prospects back they got, it made sense. One of the misconceptions is that it's because of the Yankees, the old kids that the Yankees are playing so well. Well, outside of Gary Sanchez, what kid's playing well? Aaron Judge is batting 180. Aaron Judge is also probably done for the rest of the season with that oblique injury. I doubt very much we see him again until spring training next year. Austin, it's been okay at best. And he's splitting time with Mark Teixeira anyway. And I have to wonder now if the Yankees are, in it if Teixeira plays more often down the stretch. So really the kids, they haven't done great. Shrep Schneider's been up and down. Not that he's considered a great prospect anyway. Sessa, the pitchers, they've been okay. Not great, but okay. Keeping you in games, but haven't been dominant. Luis Severino, he's a busted starter, but an ace reliever. One thing it makes you wonder is that could Severino, if the Yankees believe he's not going to be able to start for them, if he could be one of those seventh, eighth, ninth inning guys, and he's been dominant as a reliever, good stuff there. So I think it's more of the youthful exuberance. The fans are sort of re-energized. Outside of A-Rod, the players they gave away were productive. Chapman was having a good season. Miller was having a great season. Beltran was having a fantastic season. So it's not like they got rid of dead wood outside of A-Rod, but it seems like the team has been lifted as a whole. Why that is, I don't know. Sanchez has been fantastic. What is it, 14 home runs in 35 games? I believe that's a record for a rookie. So and he can catch, which is like the biggest thing. All of a sudden, he's a good catcher. He's got a gun for an arm, and I think he is the one. When we're thinking the youthful exuberance, it's all about Sanchez. All of a sudden, people start thinking, we may have a superstar here, which it does look like the Yankees actually may have, which is something that you're wondering, and I know you and I have talked about it, who is going to be the next Derek Jeter? What I mean by that, I'm not talking Hall of Famer, but I'm talking someone the fans pay to see. The Yankees didn't have that, and now it looks like they may actually have it in Sanchez, and this is not even to talk about the other young prospects they have in the organization who could end up being just as good.
Yeah, with Sanchez, this isn't something new. Sanchez was a possible Yankee starting player before they signed Brian McCann. Defense was really the issue, and I find it interesting that you mentioned now that he's also a good defensive catcher. It's more than arm. You've got to have a quick pop up, and you've got to be able to block balls and call games and like that. That's why probably Sanchez took so long to be promoted, is that the defense was the hold. We've been talking about his bat for a long time. He's been a potential star bat for ages. It's just the assumption was that he'd be a first baseman. But now you're saying, at least in short term, that defensively he looks like a lock for catcher. So based on what you've seen just in the major leagues just right now, he's a catcher for at least the next two or three seasons, and what, McCann becomes a first baseman DH and the backup guy? Is that what we're looking at in 2017? He's been that impressive on the defensive side of things?
I think McCann will get moved in the offseason. For everything I've heard, the Yankees and Braves were somewhat close to almost getting that deal done. It just comes down to how much money do the Yankees want to eat. And that probably also depends on what kind of prospect they want back, that sort of thing. Now the Braves hold the cards here, because they could say, no, we're not going to give you that much back. But I think there will be a deal worked out here. I don't think the Yankees are going to get an ace prospect. I think they'll give out someone they can use. Maybe they pay 50% of the contract somewhere around there, and it moves McCann along. Because Sanchez is going to be a starter next year. That's fairly obvious. And Romine is a fine backup. So the Yankees really don't have a problem there. The only reason you want to keep McCann around, and I shouldn't say the only reason, but an important reason could be he's an excellent clubhouse guy. He's very good with the young catches. He is teaching, so he's not upset that he's lost his job. He's a good person. So I can see the Yankees thinking that way. But in the end, what are you going to do? He's not going to play very much. He's not going to play first base. That's Tyler Austin. If he did stay with the team, sure, I can see some kind of platoon happening there. But in the end, remember, the Yankees have Greg Bird coming back next year as well. And Bird and Austin seems to be the natural platoon at first base. One's a lefty, one's a righty. That pretty much leaves McCann, out of luck here as far as playing a position, maybe DHing half the time, and I'm not so sure how much he's going to want that. Not that he would ever disrupt anything, but I think in the end, it's best overall. The Braves want McCann back. They're going into their new stadium. They want another recognizable face. They know they can get him somewhat on the cheap for the Yankees. I think a deal will be worked out, and McCann will end up back in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Again, especially if they make the money worth it, and especially if the prospects are essentially meaningless. I don't think a meaningful player is going to change hands in that deal, which makes it even more reason for both teams to come to an agreement. Like you said, essentially there's no reason for McCann to be around, and the Braves would actually like to have him in their clubhouse for all the reasons you mentioned. So it seems like a no-brainer deal, and it shouldn't be expensive for anybody. And the Yankees can just eat the money, which isn't a problem. And we'll actually talk a little bit in a few minutes about the Ryan Braun, Yasiel Puig trade rumors, because that one is a little less obvious. That's an intriguing one. Maybe it's as obvious. Maybe it's a very comparable thing to a McCann. But we'll get into that a little bit. Last time we talked was probably a month, maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago. And you talked about how Jacoby Ellsbury was essentially useless. He wasn't getting on base very much. He wasn't running anymore. And there was absolutely no power. He's got 5 home runs in the last month now, and he and Starlin Castro, you were talking about how the young guys actually aren't the guys getting it done. Ellsbury's hitting .283 over the last month. He's got, like I said, 5 home runs. Does he look rejuvenated? Have you seen a noticeable change there? It feels like he's been launching a bunch of homers over the last few weeks, and I don't know why he was so bad before, but it seems like he's fixed something recently.
Ellsbury, it's funny. He still gets roasted by the media here, and I guess by the fans somewhat as well. He's not an everyday player anymore. He didn't start last night. I know he hit the game-winning home run, but he didn't start that game. I haven't seen the lineup for today's game. The Yankees play at 4. I doubt he starts today as well as Kershaw. I think the Yankees will look to take any kind of left-hander out of their lineup that they possibly can. So the Yankees have sort of removed that from him. That's not to say he's going to sit against every left-hander, but pretty much anyone but a soft tosser, Ellsbury sits. Now, that may be because, Girardi was trying to get Judge in the lineup. And like I said, we don't have Judge anymore. Will he start Rep Snyder over Ellsbury? I don't know about that. Yankees always seem to have a thing about starting Rep Snyder. He's never really been given a chance. So I don't know if they'll do that. But I would expect that he'll remain, he'll play 5 games a week, 6 games a week. But teams tend to load up their lefties against the Yankees. So maybe not an everyday player. He has looked better. Listen, he gets a bad rap somewhat. The only negative I can really point out with Ellsbury, his defense hasn't been as good as it once was. He's dropped some fly balls, just you don't see. But he doesn't run anymore, Chris. He doesn't, and you're the Red Sox fan. You know how he used to run. He doesn't run at all. I believe he has 3 stolen bases in the last 3 months. 3 stolen bases in the last 3 months. He just doesn't run. When questioned about it the other day, he goes, well, we have so many home run hitters on our team that I don't want to get caught on the bases. Really? Didn't you have David Ortiz on your team with the Red Sox? What are you talking about? That makes no sense. And the Yankees aren't loaded with home run hitters. That just makes no sense. Why he's not running? Girardi has talked about it as well. As Girardi has said, he has the green light always. He never tells him not to run. So it's just a strange situation. And this goes to Brett Gardner as well. Neither one of these guys likes to run. I don't know why. That's a big part of their game. But it makes very little sense. It just comes down to, you would think it's the organization philosophy that they've been told. No, don't run. Don't take a chance with those outs. But Girardi says no. So someone doesn't, someone's lying here. Either Ellsbury just doesn't want to run, same thing with Gardner, or Girardi is telling them, make sure you can make it, that sort of thing. So, yes, he doesn't say no, but he's saying, hey, you get caught, you're in a lot of trouble. So it's just a strange thing, Chris, but that's the only really negative about Ellsbury. He just doesn't run.
Yeah, and I remember when he signed that enormous contract with New York. I thought it was a horrible contract. I didn't blame the Red Sox for not doing it. But in my heart, I would have liked to have seen the Red Sox keep Ellsbury just because I liked him as a player. And the things I really liked about him was I thought his defense was underrated. He was seen as a below-average center fielder defensively. I always thought he was above average. Now, granted, maybe he didn't take the best routes, and he doesn't have the best arm. Those things are facts. But he was so quick and fast, I thought he was above-average center fielder. But the quote-unquote war rankings, I think, were the opposite. But I nonetheless thought that he was an above-average center fielder defensively. And like you said, it's not as much as I love speed, because speed goes away and things like that. I just was so impressed with his success rate. And that's what's sort of strange, is that maybe he is gun-shy because he won't be successful. He was historically good at the end of his career up here in Boston. He was successful like 96% of the time. And I've always heard that if you're successful 70, 75%, then you should be stealing. That kind of percentage justifies it being a benefit to try to steal bases. And he was always astronomically better than that. It is. If he is a below average defender and he's actually slowing down and he's not running, is he a guy that maybe in the offseason, the winter meetings are kind of crazy, is he a guy that maybe gets moved if they can? Obviously, you'd have to eat a lot of money, but would that be something the Yankees wanted to do? Finding center fielders is very difficult. You can ask the Mets that question. Cross town, and you can see that. Is that something maybe we look forward to in the wintertime?
I'm sure the Yankees would like to do that, but I don't see how that's going to work for a couple of reasons. One, you haven't heard his name being mentioned at all, you know, as far as the Yankees moving him. The Yankees have to eat a lot of money. You know, I mean, a lot of money. You bet. We all knew that contract was bad when it was signed. You know, that was a reaction to what the Red Sox were doing. That's why Cashman made that deal. And like I said, the bad deals, Cashman, that's all he hears about. And Ellsbury is the bad deal that he gets raked over the coals about. You know, the A-Rod deal had nothing to do with it, Cashman. He is on record saying he wanted Cashman to go. That was all about Hank Steinbrenner. But I don't think Ellsbury gets moved, because the other problem is, well, who plays center field? You know, who's going to play center field there? The Yankees don't have anybody. You know, Hicks, sure, he's a fine center fielder, but do you want him to be an everyday player? He was just starting to hit before he got hurt. You know, so maybe he could still possibly be an everyday player, but I doubt he's going to prove that in spring training or over the last 2 weeks of the season if he does come back. You know, so that's the other issue here. Gardner is actually one. He's been bandied about now for at least 6 months that the Yankees could possibly move him. You know, his value has gone way down. He's still an above-average left fielder, but as I said, he just doesn't run anymore. And I don't think Gardner and Ellsbury, really, if they don't run, their value is just – they don't do anything else all that great. I said Gardner, not a power hitter, neither really is Ellsbury. They get on base at an okay clip, but not at an immensely great clip. I've always been wondering, as a Yankees fan, why they haven't moved one of these guys down in the order to maybe bat eighth. Why are these guys both batting 1-2 if neither one's great at getting on base and neither one will run, and they're both left-handers? You know, maybe you want to split that up a little bit. So I think Gardner would have a better chance of being moved, only because his salary is lower. So the Yankees wouldn't have to eat, maybe not have to eat any money, where Ellsbury, they'd have to eat a whole chunk. I just don't know if Hal Steinbrenner and the accountants are going to want to eat half of McCann's contract, half of Ellsbury's contract, and you're still paying off A-Rod. That's a lot of money you're eating there.
Yeah, it does sting. It hurts the pride more than anything. I think analysts would tell you that that's dead money already. So whether you remove it from the roster, whether you remove the player from the roster or not, the money should be irrelevant. But the fact is, it is. It really makes things tougher to do, just that pride aspect of it. We're talking so much in detail about the Yankees because I want to work up to the final question, which is the Yankees are still in this playoff hunt. I've called them a quasi contender, but while they are four games back of the division, even though that's not technically out of the division, four games with 16 or so to go, 16, 17, 18 games to go, that's asking a lot. So for the most part, anyone four games back or more is out of the division race. But they're only two back of the division. The one problem is what happened last night. Everyone in the AL East seems to be playing each other almost every single night. So Boston loses. Yay for the Yankees. Oh, well, unfortunately, Baltimore beat Boston, so not so yay for the Yankees. They did benefit from Toronto losing to Tampa Bay. That's one that everyone gets to benefit from. They're two games back, but you're going to keep having this seesawing, and it is difficult to leapfrog. And I don't think most analysts would say that the Yankees are better than the Jays, the Orioles, or the Red Sox. But nonetheless, they're playing better than we, I think, ever expected. Two games back, are they a legitimate wildcard? And when I say legitimate, they're absolutely in it. two games means you're in it. I'm not going to even argue that they're not. But there's so many teams you have to pass. How good of a chance do you think the Yankees have of actually getting that wild card the way that you're watching them play right now?
Listen, I'm as stunned as anybody else the Yankees are still in it. I don't get it. You know, I don't know how they're doing it. Why are they playing so much better now than they were early in the season? You know, it just doesn't make sense. Is it all because of getting rid of the old guys and the youthful exuberance is taking over? Even, they aren't play, even those youthful guys aren't playing that well? You know, it's just strange. Tanaka, I think a lot of it's starting pitching. Tanaka's been outstanding. You know, you want to talk about a guy who it's hard to believe a Yankee player could be under the radar, but Tanaka could be an under the radar guy for the Cy Young Award. And you just look at his overall numbers, they're just fantastic. He's 13-4, 3 ERA, 1.07 whip. And he's saying it's just a great season. So I think that's a big part of it, pitching. Cici Sabathia, for all the grief we've given him, and I've given him a ton of grief, has pitched well this year. He just has. Where now the Yankees, you know, probably tomorrow, they do want him to come back next year. You know, because Cici's biggest problem was after the fastball went away, he was still throwing 90-mile-per-hour fastballs down Broadway. He wasn't being a pitcher anyway. He was still trying to be a thrower, and you can get away with that when you're throwing 95, 96. Can't when you're throwing 90. But the last year now, maybe a little longer than that, he's become a pitcher, mixing up pitches. He's even found new pitches to throw. You know, he throws a slider much more often now. You know, he's using that fact that he's a lefty to his advantage. So, you know, he's been great. Pineda's been okay at best. Luis Sessa, Brian Mitchell. They're really looking more than placeholders, but they're keeping the Yankees in games right now. And that's really all that, you know, I guess that's really all you can ask for a starting staff. I don't get it, Chris. I don't know why they're still in it. I think it probably says more about the other teams, about the Baltimore Orioles. And actually, I'm not surprised about the Orioles. Their pitching staff is terrible. We all know they're pretty much, you know, either we're going to outslug you or we're going to lose. You know, the Blue Jays have their issues as well. Their staff is not very deep. And if they don't hit, they have problems. You know, the Red Sox, in my mind, are still the best overall team, but they're not a fantastic team. You have to get by David Price, who seems to have finally figured things out. Porcello, who's had a might be the leader for the Cy Young Award. You know, their staff is questionable as well. You know, we know the Red Sox can hit. So I think that's what it just shows that the rest of the division, no great teams. Nobody's going to run away with it. And the fact that they're all playing each other, you're right, it does hurt a team like the Yankees. Because if you're behind, that's a problem. You know, it's tough to make up any amount of ground on over any amount of couple of days. Because as you said, yes, you win, but so do two of the other teams. You know, although that's good for everybody is Toronto's losing again today, 6-1 to Tampa Bay. So that's another game people can grab if you can pull out a W. You mentioned the unbalanced schedule earlier in the season. I liked it originally when it first came out, 10, 15 years ago, because I thought it was more play all the teams in your division. That's great. Let's do that. You know, actually, the game should be played. The Yankees should play the Red Sox 19 times. This way you find out who the best team is to win the division. But now that you added the second wild card, I think it has to go back to a balanced schedule to make things fair. So everybody plays everybody. You shouldn't be penalized if you play in a stronger division. Because if you play in a stronger division, those are games you're going to go 500 at rather than 550. You know, and that could end up costing you a wild card. So if that's where you were going with that, I agree with you. I think now that you had the second wild card in, you need to go back to a balanced schedule.
Yeah, I think it's unfair. And while I guess you could try to make an argument that it'll be unfair differently every season, but do you really think that the Minnesota Twins and the Chicago White Sox and the Kansas City Royals are going to be playoff contenders consistently? And in order for you to make the argument that, yes, it's unfair for the East this year, but maybe it'll be unfair for the Central next year and maybe the West the year after that. The problem is Oakland struggles to contend consistently and will always for decades. So they're kind of you can rely on them not being all that competitive for 80% of the time. You look at the Twins and the White Sox and the Royals. The Royals are on a great run right now, but what happens when Hosmer leaves? What happens when Lorenzo Cain leaves as a free agent? All of a sudden, you know, the White Sox have struggled to be competitive consistently for the most part, 60 or 70% of the time. So you look at these divisions, and they're not consistently competitive enough. So it does seem like the fact that the Orioles, even though they don't get credit for spending, they do spend. They don't spend maybe as much as Orioles fans would love them to, but the Orioles spend money. And they do a pretty decent job, at least, of trading for players. And then the Blue Jays, again, they don't spend as much as the Yankees or Red Sox, but they spend enough money to stay competitive all the time. So the East, it seems like, is going to be the tougher division 8 out of 10 years. So if you're going to have an unbalanced schedule, it seems kind of unfair to have one division better than the others 70 to 80% of the time. That, to me, I think, is the strongest argument against it. if you could just flip-flop them 50-50 all the time, then I would be okay with – kind of like the NFL. The schedule fluctuates a little bit year to year. Some divisions are better or worse in year, and it is – there is a true wildness and an unknown to the NFL. That's just not the case in baseball, other than the AFC East, which the Patriots obviously dominate, and the rest of the division just sucks every single year. But other than that, the NFL has an uncertainty and a natural flow that baseball just doesn't have. And we're seeing it this year, and I don't see why we'll see it any different next year. Like you said, the free agent pool is so poor. What we're seeing right now is probably extremely similar to what we're going to see next year. These teams aren't going to be drastically different.
You're right. Now, free agency next year is not going to solve a lot of problems. I mean, it's just not. The big names aren't there. Teams are getting smarter. You know, they're signing their players longer terms earlier so they don't get the free agency and have to pay the exorbitant prices they're going to pay. So it's not going to solve a lot of problems. Now, there are some guys out there that can help teams. You know, Yoenis Cespedes could decide to be a free agent next year. We don't know yet if he's going to do it. What I imagine he is. I'd be shocked if he's not. So he could help a team if you want him. You know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But he's going to cost minimum 25 a year. And by 25, I mean million. Yeah, so that's not going to be cheap by any means. So you have to come, think about that. That's the other problem. Anybody who is a free agent next year is going to get paid a lot of money. And I'm looking at the free agent list now. I mean, Matt Wieters, okay, you need a catcher, you're good. Do you want to pay Carlos Beltran? Jose Bautista? I mean, Bautista wanted what? He wanted $150 million from the Blue Jays for a six-year contract. That's $30 million a year. That's $25 million a year. Anytime you get down here. So what do you think you're going to get there? You know, Aroldis Chapman I already mentioned, if you need a closer. Kenley Jansen will be out there. Edwin Encarnacion? Okay. So, see, there are some guys. Mark Trumbull is having a magical year. But every guy I just named here is going to want $20 million plus. With the exception of Chapman, who was for a reliever, he's probably getting $16, $17 million. Ian Desmond's going to want to recoup that nine-figure contract he turned down from Washington. I don't think he'll get it, but he's going to want to try for the gold here. So who are you hoping that's really going to fix your team? Mike Napoli? You know, another free agent. Josh Reddick. These are the guys that are out there. There's not a lot of them. You know, Rich Hill, but he's 37, 38 years old. So like I said, Frazee is not going to be what's going to save you. And you end up paying more than these guys are worth. And that's a problem. You know, I mentioned Bautista and Encarnacion, two great hitters, but they're all both up there in their 30s. You know, do you want to pay these guys really probably to play until their 40s? And we all know how that ends. The contracts end badly when the skills finally deteriorate. So, you want to build from within now more than ever, in my mind. Teams are getting smarter about this. Yeah, like I said, it's a lot of money, and not a lot of teams can afford this. Could the Yankees do it? Sure. The Red Sox? Sure. I don't think either one will. They really don't have openings at those positions. Yeah, with Dodgers, they might make some noise. They have some cash. You know, the Rangers, same sort of thing. But in the end, bottom line, free agency, not a lot out there, especially in the pitching department.
And while I said that we could see a lot of the same next season, the Blue Jays, as you just pointed out indirectly, could have some drastic changes. If Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion are blown away and the Jays just aren't willing to go to the numbers that would require it, and the speculation seems the assumption is that they'll keep one of them. But that, again, is speculation and assumption. I could see the Red Sox trying to steal away Edwin Encarnacion. He seems like he could still be a DH. And with how respectable, I want to say respectable, Hanley Ramirez has played at first base, you don't have to assume that Hanley Ramirez has to be a DH, and he's not hitting for enough power where he's an obvious DH case. So it wouldn't shock me if the Red Sox swiped Edwin Encarnacion away from the Jays, and if all of a sudden the Jays didn't want to pay what Bautista wanted, you could see how there would be a pretty significant change in what the Jays do next season. So they could be drastically different. That would be interesting. And it'll also tell the story of Pablo Sandoval. The Red Sox just walking away from Pablo, because if they're not, they probably won't go out and get an Encarnacion. Maybe they will still do it. I don't know. But it will be interesting from that perspective. Let's wrap up this conversation and bring it to a head. I asked you about whether the Yankees were going to make the wild card or not. Let me ask you real quickly, and then we'll get to Joe Girardi because I want to ask you about him. Who wins the AL East and who wins the wild card? Are there two AL East teams that get that wild card, or what do you think is that as far as how the AL East finishes up?
All right, I'm going to go Red Sox for the wild card. I think they are the best team. Actually, the Red Sox are the division. They'll win the East. I think they are the best team there. So I'm going to go with the Sox there. Wild card is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I'm not going to go with two teams from the American League East. Now, I think Baltimore falls out. I mean, it goes to the pitching. I don't think the Yankees win it either. Toronto's losing again today. Odds are going to only be one game ahead. I'm going to go Toronto, and I'm going to throw a curveball for you here. I'm going to go Seattle. I like their schedule coming up. They're playing well again. If the Taiwan Walker can figure it out, the other Hernandez will come on strong. Toronto and Seattle.
I was looking at that, and I went with the Tigers. I like their offense. I like how Verlander is pitching, and they've done pretty well without Zimmerman. So even though he's injured and maybe he won't even pitch again for them, it's not like it's essential for them to get Zimmerman back and pitching well in order for them to make a run. So he's just gravy. I call it gravy in my article for minorleagueball.com. But yes, I wanted to go outside the AL East and not just pick two teams. Toronto Blue Jays staff hasn't pitched that well. It is better than the Orioles. It is better than – it's not better than the Red Sox. It was for the first half of the season. The Red Sox have actually been the best team in the American League as far as pitching ERA goes in the second half, which I don't know if a lot of people realize that. They've been really, really good. They've started to get things. They got things together. It doesn't really look that obvious saying the Red Sox have the best starting staff in the American League in the second half. That surprises me. And when I watch them night in and night out, Drew Pomerantz couldn't even get through three full innings last night. So when I see the Red Sox on a night in and night out basis, I don't see the best staff in the American League, but the numbers, at least since the All-Star break, have been that. I had to go outside the East, but I went with Baltimore. I just don't believe in Toronto. I don't think the offense is quite good enough. It's really good, don't get me wrong, but they mashed last year, which is why they went all the way. Right now, Jose Bautista is not doing a whole lot. I don't know. I couldn't automatically jump on Toronto, even though the name value probably says that you should. I mean, you hear Donaldson, who's injured. That could be a big problem. Bautista, who's just not performing all that well. You see those names, and Carson is mashing like he seems to always do. So you see those names, and I think you should pick the Jays, but I go back to Buck Showalter, and this is going to be the perfect way for me to segue into my next question. I don't know how the Orioles do it. Their staff is ugly. Their staff has actually been bad, and yet they keep doing it. And it's not like they're going to score. They're not going to score the most runs in the American League. The Red Sox are doing that. They're not a very good offensive team, but it's not like they're running away with things because their offense is just so dominant. I don't know how they do it, and I give all the credit to Buck Showalter. I don't know how they win, but they always win more, and I don't know how to explain it. And so since I can't explain it, I usually just give the credit to Buck Showalter, and I just say, I don't know. I throw my hands up and say, I have no idea. Let me ask you about Joe Girardi. I'm starting to kind of feel that way about him. That staff, I've been telling you that they need pitching for a decade. We've been doing these podcasts for a decade. I tell you every single year that the Yankees need to trade or somehow sign an ace like Max Scherzer. They never do it, and yet they pitch well every single year. I don't know how they do it. It's the same thing as the Orioles. The Orioles win. I don't know how the Yankees do it. I don't know how the Yankees are doing it now, but I'm getting to the point now where I'm going to throw my hands up and say, I don't know what it is. I'm going to give the credit to Joe Girardi. Should he be manager of the year? Has he been great? Or is there something there that explains it and I just don't know it?
Listen, I have no idea. As I said earlier, I have no idea how the Yankees are in it. I think I'll go with the youth like everybody else will. I think Girardi has done a really good job. Listen, the Yankees should have been in it all season long. They were never one of the best teams. We knew that going in. You know, the fact that he's been able to, and they were, you know, they were desolate for a while, way out of it, 7, 8, 9 games out. Then they traded out for crying out loud. Traded out. When was the last time a team traded out yet still made the playoffs or still even involved in the playoffs at September, let's say the 14th? When was the last time? You know, do I think the Yankees are going to make it? No. But am I amazed at the job he's done? Absolutely. Now listen. Now if I can say listen one more time. Joe Girardi and 40-man rosters can drive you insane. Because that's 4-hour games. That's what that equals. Joe Girardi, 40-man rosters equals 4-hour games because he's making 1,000 pitching moves. But it's working right now. You know, have I enjoyed what he's done with Daniel Patantis all year long? No, he did the same thing last year. He puts him in too many situations where you don't need him. It does it early in the season and sort of blows him out till the end of the year. Now you do need him, and you don't have him every day. So, you know, he needs to work on that. You know, it hurt him last year, and it's hurting again the Yankees again this season. So he had some issues with the bullpen. But he said all along, even after the trades. And I know every manager says this, but Joe Girardi, we're still trying to win here. We're not that far out of it. Because although the Yankees traded out, it was mainly because the weekend before the trade deadline, they looked horrible against the Tampa Bay Rays, and Tampa got swept. So I think the players sort of did Cashman a favor. Cash was able to talk ownership into it. You know, hey, it's not working out here. We need to trade these players, get some good youngsters, blah, blah, blah. But Joe Girardi never changed what he thought. The Yankees are still involved. I think maybe the Yankees also saw there are no great teams here. The whole American League, there is no great team. We can still fight. We can still compete. Yes, we lost some talent. But maybe it also tells you, you know, the talent they lost was mainly Chapman and Miller. It just lets you know that you can replace those guys. You know, you can replace ninth inning guys, eighth inning guys. They're not as valuable as a number one starting pitcher, you know, or a guy, an everyday player. They're just not. They don't affect the game as great. Maybe that lets you know how much of an overpay the teams pay to acquire those guys. You know, so I think that plays a factor in it too. Although they give up great name players, we all know Chapman, we all know Miller. In the end, you were able to replace them with guys who are not the same caliber, certainly not, but are not going to hurt your overall team all that much either. Beltran was a loss. Yeah, and they don't have anybody to make up the offense that they lost with him, but they also got better on defense. You know, that'll save some runs there as well. It's also allowed, if they don't do this, I doubt very much they call Sanchez to give the everyday job, right? Jerry has some trust there. You know, I don't, maybe he was ordered to. Maybe Cashman told him, hey, when we make these trades, no more McCann. We want Sanchez to play every day. Yeah, we want to find out if he can be the everyday catcher. Your job is safe for next year, so don't worry about that. Put Sanchez behind the plate. Put Judge in right field. Make sure you play Austin as often as you possibly can. You know, or maybe that was all Girardi's decision. Maybe Girardi finally said, hey, I got to play these guys. I got to find out for myself if they can play. You know, but either way, kudos to him. Didn't put up a fight about it. He did it, and it's paying off.
And it's interesting you say that because that's been the perspective of baseball analytics guys for a while, that they just don't pitch enough to be a difference maker enough. And that's the crux of the argument against Zach Britton for the Cy Young, is he just – Even a very good pitcher is better than an elite closer, and so you say that, but yet loading up the back of the game with elite arms and great bullpen guys is kind of the trend where people are going. I wrote an article specifically predicting that closers were going to be the rock stars of the trade deadline, and I was absolutely proven correct. I don't see how that's going to change in the offseason. I think Chapman is going to. I think he's going to be a very well sought after reliever. He may break the largest contract a closer's ever received. That could easily happen this year. Wouldn't surprise me in the least. You see what the Royals have been able to do. Everyone gives the Royals credit based on their bullpen. My guess is if we look really, really closely, that the Royals have been really good for other reasons other than their bullpen. And that seems to be the choice. But you talk about how, and the Yankees are the example of it, that you can replace relievers. Now, granted, you still got Patances in there. But it's not like the Yankees had a bunch of eight-inning guys and 5 20-game winners on that club as starters in order to ease off the bullpen. So they traded 2 elite guys, and they're actually better. That's a simplification and maybe an inaccurate one, but there are examples on all cases of just how important or how meaningless the bullpen is, and we'll see. My argument for the Red Sox has been that Carson Smith has been the biggest loss of the season for the Red Sox. Pablo Sandoval was a gift. Him being removed from that roster, to me, was a huge benefit to their team. But Carson Smith being a shutdown eighth-inning guy, to me, the Red Sox would have 3 or 4 more games because their bullpen has been pretty bad in the second half, and they weren't able to help. They could have used that help in the first half. So it's – I don't know. I don't know how we evaluate how crucial the bullpen is. But let me put you on the spot, though. Would you give Joe Girardi the manager of the year? And I'm not going to call you a homer, a Yankee bias homer, if you say it. Because, again, if at this point, they don't even need to finish the season, in my opinion, as a winner. Or they could fall back 5 or 6 and miss it by a lot. To me, he's still done a great job no matter what happens.
I certainly think he's in the conversation. You mentioned Buck Showalter. He has to be there. You know, I think Showalter, he's got the same problems with the Yankees, and he has no pitching staff. You know, as you said, I don't know how he does it either. I know the Orioles can hit. You know, they're a big-time home run hitting team, pretty much early, the Earl Weaver team of the 70s, minus the pitching staff. You know, they live and die with a 3-run homer. Zach Britton has been a fantastic reliever. Bullpen's been good, but that starting staff, which is unusual for you to survive like that, especially in that ballpark where the ball's going to fly out, I'm certainly surprised. But I think right now, yeah, between Showalter, between Girardi. I'm looking for somebody else. John Gibson, Toronto. They won the division last year. I expect them to be pretty much where they are. So I don't know if I can give it to him. Same thing with Farrell in Boston. I'm not surprised the Red Sox are winning the division. I thought they would win the division. So I don't know if I can give it to him. Looking at some other guys that might deserve it here. I mean
Texas
Austin
is going to end up with probably the Rangers are probably going to end up with the best record in baseball.
They won last year. I mean, how much of a great job has he done, you know, Bannister? They won last year. So I don't know if I'm going to give him there. I don't see anybody that truly sticks out. Scott Service, if Seattle were to get in, I think Scott Service would have to be considered. I think he'd be their top three. Right now, the way I'm looking at it, Chris, out of Service, Showalter, Girardi, whoever gets in gets the manager of the year.
That's not a bad way to look at it. It's very possible, especially since no one seems to even notice Seattle. I mean, there is an East Coast bias. I'm not saying that the media hates the West Coast, but at the very least, they're indifferent or possibly ignore them. So if Seattle was to surge along, and they're only 2.5 back, the Yankees are 2, the Mariners are 2.5 back of the wild card. If they were to all of a sudden come on board and all of a sudden they're leading it at the end of the season, I agree. It's hard not to give it to them, even though most people probably can't name the Seattle manager. So for them to actually make the playoffs, that's saying something. Let me throw you a curveball. It probably will be tough because, again, it's easy to look at Girardi and say, wow. It's easy to look at Baltimore in that starting rotation and say, wow, Showalter's done great. And then you got Seattle that everybody ignores and no one even knows who the manager is. So I can definitely see how it would be difficult for them to get the votes, to get the vote out and win it. Let me throw a curveball before we move on here. Coming into the season, the last 2 years, the Houston Astros have been a weird story. I think the narrative has been incorrectly expressed. You know, the expectations of the Astros 1 year were probably, they shocked us. This year, I think the expectations were too high. They're probably going to miss the playoffs. They're 4.5 back of the wild card. That's a lot to overcome, especially when you have to leapfrog a lot of teams. So it looks like they're probably out of it. It may be a little premature to say that, but it's really close. If the Astros finish as expected, which is miss the playoffs, it doesn't matter how close they get, should their manager be fired?
Should the manager be fired? I don't know if it's a, I don't know if it's his fault, Scott. I don't know if it's his fault, Chris. I honestly don't know. Look at the pitching staff. McCullers was hurt from the outset. He's hurt again now. Keuchel has been a disaster for one. You have Mike Fear starting, Doug Fister starting, Joe Musgrove. That's not the manager's fault. That's the GM's fault. You know, you didn't have enough depth there. And we all know Houston can hit, but we all knew coming in that pitching could be an issue here. You know, and they never got around to fixing it, to helping out. You know, the only youngsters they have are mainly for hitting. Even the top prospects are hitters, you know, until Francis Martez comes along. So I think, I don't know if I'm going to blame the manager here. They go to a very slow start, you know, a very slow start. And that hurts somewhat. They would never really, they came close to overcoming it, but that didn't get along. What could hurt is this. What's their record against their home, you know, the team in first place, their home state rivals, against the Texas Rangers, their record is 3-15. That looks ugly. You know, you're the Red Sox fan. I'm the Yankee fan. If the manager of either team was 3-15 against the other, that would be tough to escape. And I mean tough to escape. So that would be my one worry there. You know, just says, oh, you can't beat the best team. Fans are going to start sort of call for your head. So will the media. So I might be worried about that somewhat. But I don't think it's A.J. Hinch's fault. I think this is more of they didn't have the depth of starting pitching, which is generally not on the manager. That's more on, you know, who's ever in charge of players' acquisitions. And until they fix that, they'll continue to struggle.
Yeah. If they were just 7-11, they would be possibly the favorite for the wild card. And since they're 3-15, therefore it looks like they're basically out of it. And all because of one opponent. And while I think the Texas Rangers are good, I don't think the Texas Rangers are by far and away the best team in the American League. As a matter of fact, I think you can make a pretty decent argument with the way the Red Sox are pitching that they're better than Texas. They're not going to finish with a better record. The Rangers have 6 in the win column and 4 in the loss column, so they are going to outwin the Red Sox for the season in the American League when it comes to the final record. But I think the Texas Rangers are a good team. I think they're a pretty decent team. I don't think they're special, and you could make a decent argument that the reason why they'll be the best team in the American League as far as the finishing record is because they pounded the Astros. I mean, you throw that stat out there, take away 5 wins of that, and all of a sudden they have 82 wins instead of 87, and all of a sudden you've got Cleveland as the best team in the American League right now. So you could look at, and then they get to play the Angels and the Oakland all those games. So you could, I think you can make a pretty good argument that the Rangers are propped up on this unbalanced schedule, which we talked about to begin to bring it all around. I think the Rangers are a good team. I don't think they're a perennial favorite, but with Darvish and Hamels, you know, they have a chance. I mean, any two aces at the top can always get it done, but I'm not thinking that the Rangers are the elite runaway best team in the American League.
I think they might be the best team in the American League, but that's just the best team. I don't think they're a great team by any means. I certainly don't think they're elite, not to what, you know, 1998 Yankees or something like that. I don't think they're of that range at all. And I don't think they're that much better than Cleveland. Cleveland has issues now with the starting staff. Bauer looks like he's wilting on the long season. Salazar, we don't know if he's going to pitch again. So that's going to be a problem for them. But, you know, in a 5-game series, really anything can happen. And I still think the Rangers and Red Sox are sort of heading for a showdown there of some sort. I think those are two teams that, and I'd like to see that here. I think a lot of runs would be scored. I think it'd be fun. But I think they are probably the best team, best overall team, but not a great team. And with the Rangers, I wonder if you can get to that bullpen. I mean, you can get to this team. And like the Red Sox, do they have a third starter? You know, okay, Hamels, great. Darvish, great. I don't know if I trust anybody after that. You know, Hamels, you know, I just have my issues there. I think they're a good team. Not so sure they're actually, I shouldn't say not so sure. I don't think they're a great team at all.
Let me talk to you about the New York Mets before we wrap this up a little bit here. First, let me talk to you about Daniel Murphy. The Mets seem to do a lot to avoid having to give Daniel Murphy a big contract. I didn't have a problem with it because, as I pointed out in our podcast the other day, I didn't think he had a perfect fit. Offensively, he was an above-average second baseman from an offensive perspective, but he was a well-below-average defensive second baseman. Then you move him over to third. Maybe he's an average defender at third, but he's probably a little bit of below average offensive player for a third baseman, though this year he's proven me wrong on that case. But I wouldn't call him an elite offensive third baseman with the way he profiles. And then he gets even less valuable if you move him over to first. So when you combine his offensive ability, which was above average, to his below average defensive skills, I didn't love him for any team in the entire league. I didn't love paying him a big contract. So I had no problem with the Mets not loving the idea of paying him. But he's proven me wrong. He's been phenomenal. I think you make an argument that he's by far and away the best Nationals player. If he didn't perform the way he did in the first half and he's continued it all the way through here to the second, that the Nationals would probably still make the playoffs, but they wouldn't have a 6 or 7-game lead on the Mets. They would be fighting for the division and the wild card rather than running away with it and kind of hiding as we get here into the middle of September. Did the Mets make a big mistake, a small mistake, or not a mistake at all? Would the Mets be in the playoffs already if Daniel Murphy was a Met, I guess is my question. And by that, by subtraction, you know, they flopped. So all of the good went to the Nationals and all the good went away from the Mets. Is that one signing the reason why we have the standings in the NL East right now?
In some ways, yes. I mean, the Nationals have a 9-game lead. I'm sorry, Murphy's not worth 9 games. You know, plus they would have had someone else in there. It wasn't like they would leave second base open, so they would have had someone else in there who would be a decent player. You know, they tried to get Brandon Phillips first. Brandon Phillips turned down a deal, so he didn't want to leave Cincinnati. Well, fine and good. Did the Mets make a mistake? Probably not, because all the reasons you mentioned. I mean, they're all true. He really had no defensive position. He made a couple of mistakes in the World Series last year on defense that cost the team. We know he can hit. Yeah, I don't know if we saw 25 home runs coming, but we know he can hit. His problem was always going to be finding a defensive position. And the Mets may have thought the money that he was going to get, or they thought he was going to get, was going to be too exorbitant for them. They were able to get Neil Walker, who had a decent season for them. You know, better defensively, not quite as good offensively, but not a zero either. So I don't think the Mets necessarily made a mistake here, assuming, and this is the problem with the Mets. You know, assuming, and like I said, this is a big assumption when it comes to the Mets, that the money they saved by not starting Murphy, they would put into the team at another position. And that's always the problem with the Mets. You know, maybe letting Murphy go allowed them to sign Neil Walker and Cespedes. And if it did, I'm fine with that. You know, but for all we know, they were going to sign Cespedes anyway. Walker's a replacement, and they just pocketed the extra money. That's the problem with the image when it comes to the Mets, that that's what they do. They're more worried about the money than they are making the team better. And if that's the truth, then yes, they hurt themselves. You asked if the Mets had kept Murphy, would they already be in the playoffs? Well, I think they'd be pretty much a lock. Because although Neil Walker has played well, he's out for the season now. I think he'd give him, you know, he could say three games more than Mets would have won here. So they'd be solidly in a wild card spot. I don't think they'd be competing for the division. I don't think there's going to be a 9-game lead from the Nationals, but maybe it's 5, and that's enough. You know, at this point in the season, no one's going to make up 5 games. It's extremely difficult unless you just completely go with the choke mode. So I think Murphy absolutely would have helped the Mets, but I think in the end they probably did the right thing, but without knowing really what was going on inside that organization, there's really no way to tell for sure.
Yeah, and the one argument, if you wanted to argue that it is that you let's say he's worth 4 games. So let's say he's worth 3, whichever number you want to choose. You deduct 3 from the Nationals, and then you add 3 to the Mets, or vice versa. All of a sudden, it's 80 wins for the Mets and 83 for the Nationals, or 82 for the Nationals and 81 for the Mets. It gets at least intriguing, and that's sort of what I said at the beginning. Was that, would that flip-flop the two, and the Mets would be dominating, and the Nationals wouldn't be? No, that's asking too much. Like you said, 9 games for any one player. You can have doubts about the accuracy of WAR, but saying that Daniel Murphy with 2 weeks still to go is a 9-win player is you know, saying, wow, I didn't know that Mickey Mantle was back in baseball. But it's at least an interesting topic to discuss here. Let me ask you about Yennis Cespedes. Is he going to carry the Mets to the playoffs again? I guess that's the question. Is Cespedes going to play well enough to get them into the playoffs, and do you think the Mets are going to win one of the wildcard spots?
Yeah, I think the Mets are going to get him pretty easily, mainly because of schedule. I mean, it's just cake. There are a lot of Braves, a lot of Reds on the schedule. Minnesota Twins, they still have to play. And maybe more importantly, the Giants and Cardinals are imploding. Right? Giants don't have a closer anymore, or an eighth. They don't have a bullpen anymore. So they're having all sorts of issues there. The Cardinals have been, you know, maybe, I think the Cardinals may have run out of gas. You know, they're not playing well either, and the Cardinals' schedule is just rough. They're losing again today to the Cubs. They still have to play the Cubs again. You know, so I think the Cardinals are in a lot of trouble. I think the Mets get the first wild card spot. I'm more curious is I don't know who's going to get the second one. You know, I think the Marlins and Pirates are too far out of it at 5 and 6 games each. I think the Giants and Cardinals are going to get one of them's going to get in purely by the because they're going to back in. So I think they might lose more than they win, but they'll back in because someone has to get in there. And if I had to bet right now, I'm going to take the Giants once again because of schedule.
And I was talking about this with the podcast with Brandon C. Williams yesterday, and it's posted over at minorleagueball.com, or it will be, or it's also posted over on Facebook, a podcast to be named later. They play this weekend. I believe it's a 4-game set in San Francisco, Cardinals versus Giants. I was discussing the fact that who gets in, the Cardinals or the Mets? Depending on what happens this weekend, it's probably just the opposite. The Mets are probably in. I didn't say this yesterday, and I'm kind of coming along to your side of things now. After that weekend series, it could split and everything could be the exact same with 5 less games left to go. But if the Cardinals or the Giants kind of pound on one or the other this weekend in that 4-game set, all of a sudden the Mets will be catapulted in. Like you said, they get in easily, and then the other team runs away with the second one. And this isn't even all that tasty of a discussion, 7 days from now. That weekend series is gigantic. Must watch if you care about the National League wild card at all.
And when you look at the Cardinals' schedule, like I said, they're playing the Cubs today, they're losing. You mentioned the 4 games at San Fran, which means they're all about the outs on the West Coast, too. They're 3 games at Colorado. That sounds easy, but that's no fun. Then you have 3 games at Chicago. Then you get 4 versus Cincinnati, but Cincinnati's playing well, and you close out versus Pittsburgh, a team that's probably playing out the string. So I think they have to split with San Fran. If you can do better than that, that's great. You know, because that Cubs series, you're probably losing 2 out of 3. Colorado, you need to take 2 out of 3, and then you need to clean up against Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. You just have to do it to have any chance here. That's my issue there. But I think most importantly, Cardinals and Giants, they're not playing well. They're just not playing well. And I don't know, can either team turn it around? And it's September. You're not bored. You know you have to win here. By the way, for those wondering about the Giants schedule, they finish up against San Diego. We know the 4 games against St. Louis. Then they have 3 against the Dodgers. But then 4 at San Diego, they play Colorado for 3, and they close out against the Dodgers, which sounds big, but that could mean absolutely nothing for the Dodgers which means maybe you don't see Clayton Kershaw. You know, maybe you don't see Rich Hill. Or you see him for a very abbreviated stint as the Dodgers prepare for the playoffs, not worried about keeping the Giants out of the playoffs.
Yeah, and I would love to be able to ask if you think the Dodgers have a chance to maybe blow the West, but with you, with your analysis of the Giants and the fact that their bullpen's a disaster and they're collapsing, even though they're a four-game lead, and other than AL East, there aren't any divisions in contention. And even though the Giants are only four back, they're not really in contention for the West either, right? Like you said, the Dodgers walk away with that and they coast in.
Yeah, I think the Dodgers absolutely walk away with the division there. Listen, there's always a chance that the Giants wake up and all of a sudden they play very well in those head-to-head matchups. You know, they are playing the Dodgers in the 19th, 20th, and 21st. They're in L.A. If they could sweep, obviously they have to take at least two out of three, but if they could sweep, they can make it interesting again. But right now, it's just not looking good in Giant land. They've already removed San Diego Casilla. Strickland last night blew up, and he blew that game against the Padres. They don't seem to want to put Sergio Romo in the role. Maybe they don't like him there. The bullpen is a mess.
Looking at the Dodgers, Yasiel Puig, I want to ask you about the Braun rumors in a second, but first, Puig on his own. He's on fire. He's only facing lefties for the most part. He's had a few at-bats against right-handers, and he's done pretty well against them as well, but it looks like the Dodgers are trying to platoon Reddick and Puig. I don't know exactly why. If Puig is on fire with his potential, it seems like he has to be in there every day. It's not like the Dodgers are an offensive juggernaut, and Reddick has been awful. But at least for now, it seems like the Dodgers don't want to give Puig the full-time job. You actually are seeing them against the Yankees this week. Are you seeing or hearing anything about Puig? Do you think that the Dodgers are going to finally transition him to a full-time player? And how important is he to the Dodgers' chances of winning a World Series? Is he a key piece, or should they keep him, you know, under wraps and limit his access and limit his effect? He's almost like a cancer the way they talk about him sometimes. But when he's hitting, it seems like he's a positive much more than a negative. What are your thoughts on Puig with that Dodgers team in their future?
Oh, I think Puig, as far as this season, Puig is immensely important because he's a right-handed hitter. That Dodger line is extremely left-handed. You saw the Yankees, Sabathia shut them down last night. It's like every left-hander does that. And the Dodgers don't figure this out real quick because that's all they're going to see. He's going to load up to play every lefty they can against them. So Puig is important there. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's playing well. Maybe this is finally a wake-up call for him. I mean, finally, where he's taking the game more seriously, being more mature, not ticking everybody off the door with his antics, maybe. You hope it is. But he's showing more power, too. He's not. It looks like he's guessing anymore. It looks like the mechanics are back to where they should be. So I like what I'm seeing from Puig. As for the proposed trade, for everything I've heard, that trade would have been done if the deadline was 3:30 and not 3 o'clock. They just needed more time to get, I guess, all the nuances figured out with both contracts. So it's certainly something that could be revisited in the offseason. Same thing, Braun's a right-handed hitter. It would give some balance to that lineup. Certainly help. You know, he's less of a problem outside of the steroid things. He has no problems other than that, and that seems to be in his past. So the Dodgers might feel they can live with that. The money-wise, okay, Dodgers taking on more money, but they're getting a better player. I don't think there's any doubt that Braun's a better player than Puig. Puig may have upside, which I definitely think he does, but the Dodgers may feel like, you know, we'll pay the extra money. It doesn't really matter to us. We have plenty of money, and we get the more definite thing, and it rids us of a possible locker room headache. You know, while if we can remove it and get a better player, it's just money. We print it. Let's do this.
Yeah, I wonder about that. In fantasy purposes, I refuse to trade Yasiel Puig for Zach Britton in a dynasty league because I love the Puig talent. But after we're refusing it, I was kind of regretting it. And that to me is the essence of Puig. I had no clue how to value him in yearly leagues this year. I didn't know where you should draft him. And then at the end of the season when everything was looking awful, I couldn't do that for Britton for a closer because this guy's too talented to give away for a closer, even though Zach Britton is an elite closer. And I didn't need closers. So it wasn't like I was desperate and I was feeling a need. It was more of a who do I think is more valuable. I'm going to go into next year probably thinking the same thing from a fantasy perspective, right? We just don't know what the heck we're getting from Puig. And it looks like we don't even know where he'll be. It's a, you know, Puig is just an enigma.
He is. I mean, he came on when he first came here. He came on, bat out of fire. He's playing great. And then he didn't have all the issues. Didn't know how to run. Didn't know all the fundamentals. Didn't know how to act in the clubhouse. You know, ticked a lot of his teammates off. A lot of talk behind his back about how he was reacting. So which Dodgers finally, I guess, had enough 3 years later. He still has talent. It's a matter of maturity. When will he mature? We see this a lot with young kids. Who do we start off talking about today? Gary Sanchez. A big part of his problem, other than the defensive issues, was maturity. He got suspended a couple of times in the Yankee minor league system for acting like an idiot. You know, Puig Sorbis is the same thing here, and you're hoping eventually he puts it all together, grows up, and, you know, takes the game. See more. I know it's a game, but you got to take it seriously. It is a job. You know, players want to win. The fans want you to win. The media wants you to win. So when does that click in for him? That's why the Dodgers, in my mind, they'd like to do if they could have had that extra half hour, I think the trade would have been done. But Puig, he's playing well now. Suppose that continues through the playoffs. Then they won't trade him. They're going to realize, okay, we got to sit on this upside here. He's finally clicking in here. We think he's going to figure things out. He's going to go back to being that monster that we think he could be. I think if that happens, they say good next 3 weeks, good playoffs, then he'll stay.
And the one thing that could still make that trade happen is that the Brewers have a lot of potential outfielders and prospects coming up through that system. It's a crowded roster. If they really like Puig, they can't give up one of those young talents in order to make the trade happen. So if the Dodgers are saying we're giving him away too cheaply, the Brewers could up their offer. They could up their offer and make it happen if they wanted to. We'll see. They have the talent. They'd give Braun, but if somehow, you know, the Dodgers
wanted
more or something.
They're not giving up anything more than Braun.
Okay. Then there isn't, but they could. We're wrapping up the program here. George, one last question. We're finishing on a fantasy note here. I was talking with Brancy Williams about Trea Turner next year, and there were some whispers that you could make an argument that Trea Turner could be a top 10 or at least a top 15 player next year because he could qualify at shortstop. He hits for some power. He could steal 40 or 50 bases. I've heard whispers about where Trea Turner may go in years of league and drafts. So I asked that about Brandon C. Williams. With Gary Sanchez, with how amazing he's been, with how many homers he's hit this year, with how people projected forward Carlos Correa, I mean, they looked at Carlos Correa's 2015 and said, wow, with a full season, he's going to be better next year, and he skyrocketed into the middle of the first round in this year's draft. Could you see Sanchez being a top 25 pick? The catcher position now is essentially, along with tight end, the only position scarcity spots in all of fantasy sports now. If Sanchez finishes as strong as he's been playing, could he be a top 15, top 20, top 25 pick and be drafted ahead of Buster Posey in yearly league?
I'm going to say no. I still hate catcher. I'm certainly not taking Sanchez top 25. That's true. I won't have him. I wouldn't even come close to having him in any league. Could I see you taking him above Posey? Sure, I could see that, mainly because, American League, Yankee Stadium, and he does hit the ball to right center. His power is there as well. He'll hit more home runs than Posey. I don't think there's any doubt about that. May drive in more runs. And with the Yankee lineup not going to be loaded with veterans, he's probably going to hit fourth or right around. He's in third right now, so it's not like he's going to bat low in the lineup there. So, yeah, I can see Sanchez going ahead of Posey. Top 25 pick is psychotic in my mind. That's third round. I think that's nuts. But then again, for years I've been thinking guys who's like Posey that early were nuts too. You know my philosophy on catcher. You know it damn well. I hate him. And I'm not taking any early. That's not to say I don't have Sanchez in a league and keep a deep dynasty and keeper leagues. I have it two leagues actually because I drafted him when he was a rookie. So I'm happy to have him, absolutely. But I'm not spending I won't spend a top 50 pick on him. Probably not a top 75 pick. I just believe catcher's like I can wait a while. He's still going to sit once a week. I don't know if he's going to get that DH spot on that day off or anything like that. So he won't play as much as other players. Love his future as a Yankee fan. Glad to see it. I think he's going to be very good. I don't know about great, but very good. But fantasy-wise, no thank you. Top 25 pick, he is all yours. And as a Trea Turner, what league does he qualify at shortstop? Has he even played short this year? It certainly hasn't got the minimum 10, 20 games for most leagues. So I don't know, top 10, top 15 player, I think that's a little psychotic too.
Well, I think he will play shortstop next year. That's a speculation that in Yahoo, all you need to do is think about playing a position and you qualify. But if he does, if he is a starting shortstop and to start the season, then he will eventually become a shortstop early in the season. And some leagues use kind of a common sense approach. A lot of my keeper leagues use a common sense approach where if a guy is announced at a position, the commissioner gives him that eligibility. But some leagues, you only need 5 games. Some maybe need 15 or 20. But if Trea Turner is the starting shortstop to start the season, I would assume he'll be drafted as if he is one because he'll become one pretty quickly. But, yeah, I believe it's too high too. But, again, there are some whispers. Just to finish it up, when we get out of here, Buster Posey was 22. His ADP was 22 this year. So if Sanchez is going to have more RBIs, if he's definitely going to hit more home runs, I agree with you. I never draft Posey. I would never draft him 22. But for the most part, every year he goes in that 20 to 30 range. If that is what people think a really good catcher should be, you could argue that if Posey's going to go 22, then maybe Sanchez should go 20, 22, 23, 24, too. I agree with you. It's nuts. But every single year there's a crazy owner in every single league that drafts Buster Posey in the top 25.
Well, good luck to you. That crazy owner will not be me.
George Kurtz from RotoExperts.com, thanks for spending the time with us today. Look forward to talking more sports with you in the future. But keep up the good work over at RotoExperts.com, man.
Thank you so much, Chris. Good talking with you.
All right, that's George Kurtz again. He's on SiriusXM. He's on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. You can read his content over at RotoExperts.com, where he talks football, baseball, hockey. I'm surprised he's not doing soccer and golf and everything else. He does everything over there at RotoExperts.com. If you want to talk with him about any fantasy sport or any baseball sport, I mean, we only kind of dabbled in fantasy right now. He obviously talks baseball in general as well. Follow him on Twitter at George Kurtz. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I'm going to switch over. We're going to talk some fantasy football with Drew Loftus on our other program here, the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show. But thanks, everybody, today talking some baseball. You can follow our podcast over at minorleagueball.com. If you want to read about my minor league prospects and their fantasy relevance, you can head on over to rotoexperts.com. Or if you want to talk with me on Facebook, on any of the different Facebook groups that I follow or run, it's a podcast to be named later for this show or the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show for the other. Again, I'll be talking with the New York Post fantasy football writer Drew Loftus about week number one, and then a look ahead at week number two and taking fantasy questions. So if you're tuning in live today, we're glad to have you. If you want to listen to that program, you can find that as well, or just go to Facebook or Twitter for the links. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Be good, and enjoy your fantasy sports this weekend, friends.